So,
readiness potentials. I thought I'd be seeing pictures of readiness potentials all day, but we saw some with Professor Lung in the last talk. But the Bereitschaft potential, readiness potential, is now over 50 years since it was discovered. This was something about 10 years after the discovery, this picture that I use in all my talks. But it's a slow increase in brain activity, we think, coming from supplementary motor area, begins 1 second or so before voluntary movement. One thing that's particularly difficult for us with readiness potential is to localize exactly where in the brain this activity is coming from. And that's been a lot of focus of research that I've done. So I was came here to Vienna in 1998, straight after my PhD, 20 years ago now. And this was some of the work that I did with Christian Windischberger at the time and Ewald Moser in the MRI center with their 3T MRI scanner, one of the highest field scanners in the world at the time in Vienna. And we used functional MRI with a very fast acquisition time, so a really fast sampling rate to get lots of time information, trying to identify activity sources of this pre-movement activity and planning actions. And with our rapid method, we were able to look at some really nice movies, if you like, time evolution of activity in midline areas like supplementary motor area here and in primary motor cortex, of course, as people are performing free will voluntary actions. With our high time resolution, we're able to plot out those bold responses that we see. Of course, with fMRI, we're always dealing with a signal that is very slow and delayed. So it reaches a peak always well after several seconds after the neural activity we want to measure. So still with planning, if you want to see activity related to planning of action, with bold fMRI, we're only seeing changes in blood flow that are several seconds after the movement's being performed. But nonetheless, if we plot out bold responses in supplementary motor area in blue and in primary motor cortex here in the pink colour, generally we see activity starting first in supplementary motor area, second in primary motor cortex. Primary motor cortex, of course, we think is just executing movement. This fits with SMA playing a role in this planning activity. Nonetheless, this activity we see is still several seconds after movement, so saying it's the planning pre-movement activity is a little difficult. So, recent studies been doing in Australia, we've used concurrent EEG and fMRI techniques. So we measure EEG inside the MRI scanner, we have people doing a readiness potential task, basically lying in the scanner and every 4 to 8 seconds make a voluntary finger movement. And we're able to measure brain activation with the fMRI and measure EEG concurrently. This is a study we did with 20 healthy young participants. And from the fMRI data, we see really nice localization of activity just associated with movement, particularly here through the midline areas. This is the mid-cingulate cortex and the supplementary motor area, of course, and also activity, well, in here in lateral premotor, but primary motor areas on the contralateral side. Concurrently with this fMRI, we're able to average really nice-looking readiness potentials. It's quite challenging to remove all of the hideous artifact that we get from the MRI scanner on the EEG signal. Quite a lot of work involved in data cleaning, but after all of that, we can actually measure very nice readiness potentials concurrent with fMRI. So here, typical increasing negativity, 1 second or so beginning before movement. Larger on the contralateral hemisphere, C3 than C4, and a topography that looks pretty classic for readiness potential, mostly midline activity, slightly lateralized to the side contralateral to movement. The whole point of recording these concurrently is for our studies here was to really determine what brain activity we'd see with fMRI, was most closely correlated, related to the amplitude of pre-movement activity we see in the EEG. And so our aim in this study was actually to estimate readiness potential amplitudes in single trials, in individual trials. And anyone who's worked with the EEG data knows you look at a single trial of EEG for readiness potential, you can't really see a readiness potential. So estimating these amplitudes in individual trials is quite challenging. What we did was, rather than looking at signals, say, just at individual electrodes, we calculated the global field power. And that is just the sum of absolute voltage across all channels, across the scalp. And this works quite well for readiness potentials because readiness potential is very widespread across the scalp. We see it in many, many channels. So the sum of all channels shows quite strong activity with similar appearance to readiness potential in global field power, but has a great advantage in signal-to-noise, so much better signal-to-noise for individual trial analysis. Just to ensure that what we're seeing in global field power really represented readiness potentials, we also, first of all, just checked correlations across participants, but our correlations between what we see as global field power amplitude and readiness potential amplitudes in particular channels. And so this is independent of the fMRI, but so for all of our analysis, what we actually do is divide this 1 second period before movement into four time bins, every 250 millisecond interval, and measure the average amplitude over each 250 milliseconds. So that gives us these values we quantify, and we can see that these amplitudes for readiness potentials over prefrontal and frontocentral channels here correlate, these are with the star the ones that are significant, but they correlate strongly with the amplitudes we see in global field power, unlike the parietal channels at the back. So what we see is, say, readiness potential amplitudes in the posterior channels don't correlate with global field power either. So global field power seems to be a good indicator for us of readiness potentials and good for our purpose for this study. Oh, I'm going backwards, sorry. I'll use my big button. That'll do it. Okay, so now we've got global field power to analyse. We can estimate amplitudes of, like, the voltage amplitudes in global field power on every individual trial. I will go back a bit. Here we have all our participants. They made approximately 250 to 300 voluntary movements through the whole experiment. So that's how many trials we have for averaging readiness potentials. But across all these trials, there's going to be variation in some readiness potentials being high amplitude and some low amplitude from trial to trial. We use that trial to trial variability to correlate with activity from fMRI. So we obtained these single trial estimates of amplitudes of global field power across all trials in these four different time bins, and we essentially just entered those values as another regressor into our fMRI analysis. That meant we could identify brain regions that showed changes in activity that were correlated with the EEG activity we see in these pre-movement periods. Oh. Okay. So when doing all of the proper, very stringent correction for multiple comparisons that we have to do with fMRI, we actually find this small region in the anterior mid-cingulate cortex whose activity was significantly correlated with the pre-movement EEG activity we see over this period from 750 to 250 milliseconds prior to movement. So trials in which readiness potential over this period was very large, we'd see stronger bold activity in this part of the anterior mid-cingulate cortex, which gives us really nice evidence for sort of tying that bold activation to pre-movement EEG activity in that period. This is with proper family-wise error correction. With fMRI, we have to correct for many, many thousands of statistical comparisons. I should say that tiny spot in the anterior mid-cingulate cortex is not the only area that shows a correlation with pre-movement EEG activity. If we relax our statistical threshold, look at called uncorrected thresholds, we do see quite a wide network through the these midline areas, the cingulate cortex up into supplementary motor area, that all do show some correlation with pre-movement EEG activity, just not at that strictly corrected significant level as the anterior mid-cingulate cortex. Okay, so we went on from there. Now we can see this relationship between activity in the mid-cingulate cortex and early pre-movement EEG activity. We went to test a connectivity model that could explain our MRI data of interactions between the mid-cingulate cortex and the supplementary motor area in this movement planning time. And we used dynamic causal modelling, which is a part of the SPM package from London. So this work is all in collaboration with Michael Breakspear, a professor in Brisbane now, but has done a lot of work with dynamic causal modelling. That's why we follow this route. We created a whole set, a family of 36 different possible models that could explain interactions between the SMA and the mid-cingulate cortex. And the point of our dynamic causal modelling was to identify the model that could best explain the data that we observed. So across our whole family of models, we just created a whole family of plausible models, and we aim to identify the most likely one given the data. So we were just interested in the mid-cingulate cortex and the supplementary motor area and how they interact. And in dynamic causal modelling, these we call our nodes in the network. Each of these nodes, so they influence each other. But each node also has this we call self-connection loop. And this can control how activity is sustained or dampened in this area over time. First of all, in constructing these models, we wanted to identify So we have a relationship between activity in the mid-cingulate cortex and global field power or pre-movement activity. So we wanted to identify what could be the cause of this activity in mid-cingulate cortex that is associated with high pre-movement activity. It could be that on trials where global field power or the pre-movement activity is very, very high, it actually represents the mid-cingulate cortex here sort of increasing its own sustaining of activity. Or it could be that on trials with high pre-movement EEG activity, those are trials where the supplementary motor area is particularly driving activity of the mid-cingulate cortex. Both of these would explain a correlation between our global field power and mid-cingulate cortex. So they're both plausible models. We then added to our models what we call nonlinear connections. So in this small network, in traditional DCM would be a fully connected network, but the newer methods, we can include nonlinear influences here. So we could also test whether maybe activity in the supplementary motor area has an effect on how mid-cingulate cortex kind of sustains its activity, or vice versa, how mid-cingulate cortex could influence the way the SMA sustains its activity over time. So we added that to our model. That creates another family of models. Also with dynamic causal modelling, we have to have input into the model. These have been used a lot to explain processing of sensory information and the flow of information through a network. And always with sensory input, we have a clear driving input to the brain that comes from the senses. So we'd have driving input starting from primary visual cortex, for example, for a visual task. But dealing with the motor system, it's a bit hard to say for us to say where is the driving input into this network. So what is coming before SMA or before mid-cingulate cortex that's driving activity to this network? We didn't have any strong hypotheses about that, so we tested all possible combinations of driving input to one or the other or both. Okay. So out of all that family of models we created, this was the one that was the best explainer of the data as we observed it, and that is one where the mid-cingulate cortex here, its self-feedback connection is the one that's modulated according to pre-movement EEG activity. So what we see is this relationship between the pre-movement EEG and mid-cingulate cortex actually represents mid-cingulate cortex kind of increasing the way that it sustains its own activity over time. Importantly as well, the mid-cingulate cortex has this non-linear effect on SMA activity. So as well as sustaining its own activity, it's also driving this SMA to sustain its activity pre-movement. So overall, we suggest that the anterior mid-cingulate cortex is doing this sustaining activity pre-movement and doing this more so when the Borrachias potential amplitude is large, and also driving that sustained activity in the SMA prior to movement. Okay, so overall results we get from this combined EEG fMRI tell us that the anterior mid-cingulate cortex is correlated with that pre-movement EEG activity. So larger readiness potential activity is associated with more activity in that part of mid-cingulate cortex. And we think that that represents this role in sustaining its own pre-movement activity and driving that sustained activity of the SMA. Okay, so I'm going to move on to something that's quite new coming from this, and this is, you can see the slide, so this is quite new, and data I just got a couple of days ago sent through to me and I put together. So we have this model of the mid-cingulate cortex, SMA, sustaining activity prior to movement, quite a new paper came out by Scherger some years ago suggesting that readiness potential actually doesn't exist as anything special. It's kind of a consequence of our averaging process. And their model went something like this, that for free will decisions for action, when we know in a readiness potential experiment, participant is waiting for some time and making a free will voluntary movement, that brain activity underlying this will be a combination of two things. One is natural, normal oscillations of the brain, particularly low frequency oscillations that are just always there, so oscillatory activity, plus an increasing imperative. They call it this imperative signal. Over time, it becomes more likely the person's going to make their movement. They know there's kind of a time limit, and there'll be an increasing kind of imperative. And the sum of these together gives this kind of ramping up activity, but with also slow wave oscillations. And what Scherger kind of introduced is that this idea that comes from a lot of decision neuroscience, that there's some sort of decision threshold, and the time when a person initiates action is when this neural activity exceeds the decision threshold, kind of triggers the initiation of movement. When we have these slow oscillations overlaid on this rising activity, that point at which neural activity crosses a decision threshold is most likely going to be on a rising phase of this oscillatory activity, just because that's the first point where activity will be high enough to cross the decision threshold. This is a nice model. And what comes from that, Scherger says, is naturally, if you take this point of movement initiation in many, many trials and average them together, what you'll always see in the EEG is a preceding negativity. But as Scherger says, this is because that's on a rising phase of a natural slow wave oscillation that's underlying. I want to leave that argument alone, but introduce this idea of slow wave oscillations. So what we set out to do was identify or examine whether we could actually influence the participants' time at which they free will decided to initiate movement by using alternating current brain stimulation TACS, tach stimulation. With an alternating current stimulation, what we did was use a combination of electrode pads, cathode and anode, over the frontal lobes and right at the back of the occipital lobe. And what we're actually doing is inducing an alternating current, electrical current, between these two electrodes in a sinusoidal pattern. And when we do that, so we'd be pulling current through the supplementary motor area, through the midline motor areas, here this is plotted with negative going up. The negative peaks in these oscillations is when neuronal excitability would be greatest in motor cortex. So with this stimulation, we're inducing neuronal oscillations and inducing times when motor cortex excitability will be higher in these negative peaks and lower in the positive peaks. And what we simply set out to do is test whether people are more likely to initiate their movements in some particular phase of this brain stimulation, probably when excitability is highest in this negative phase. And our new results. Here we can see the topography of the stimulation we caused with our electrode pads over the frontal and posterior areas. So we're, and it's alternating current. So it alternates between this being negative, positive, and vice versa, positive and negative. It's actually 0.5 hertz, so a 2 second cycle. And indeed, with active stimulation over the SMA, what we find is these are just histograms plotted in a circle because it's, the cycle is circular. These are the times when actually our participants are most likely to initiate movement. Well, they initiated the most movements in these parts that corresponded to the negative phase of the stimulation. We also had a sham stimulation condition. So what we did with the stimulator, we slowly ramp up the activity over, in this case it was over 30 seconds, slowly increasing the amplitude. And when we do that, participants have no sensation of the stimulation at all. They can't tell the difference between a stimulation and a sham block. As long as we use a slow ramp up activity. So our sham condition, we slowly ramped up the activity and then immediately ramped down, and participants performed the experiment actually with no brain stimulation in the sham condition. And there we see no particular pattern of the time they initiate movement with a phase relationship that we would have with the stimulation. So summary of that, quite remarkably, we're influencing the time at which participants make their decision to initiate movement. Participants are more likely to initiate their actions in these negative phases of the brain stimulation. What I find really amazing about this, participants have no awareness whatsoever of the stimulation. They certainly can't feel the cycles, so there's no timing cue involved with stimulation. And most of the time, they're completely unaware of whether a particular block is with active stimulation or the sham condition. But nonetheless, we're influencing their voluntary choices for initiating movement. And it also fits with this theory we have that the increasing SMA activity in a way primes motor cortex, increases excitability in motor cortex in readiness for action. And in this case, we see that's most likely facilitating initiation of movement. Raises lots of interesting questions, like nobody's mentioned free will either, unless I didn't understand it in German. But what does this mean for free will, the nature of free will? If participants still have this perception that their movements are entirely under their own volitional free will control, but we are nonetheless influencing their movements by the external brain stimulation, which is quite interesting. I don't get too much involved in the philosophical discussions around free will, but it's overall supports this idea that there are particular underlying brain states that will bias us towards particular choices or responses at different times. So in this experiment, we're certainly not determining movements people make. We're just biasing somehow their choices. And so I think we're inducing some underlying brain state that makes it more likely people will initiate movement at that time. But that's quite different from determining, in a deterministic way, their actions. So, this is my beautiful university campus in Brisbane, and sunshine just like here in Vienna. It's quite amazing. I'd like to acknowledge my lab group and collaborators in this work. Thank you.